Hello, this is the Truth for Your 20s podcast, and you guys are going to have so much fun today. I have with me my new friend, Molly Stillman. She is no big deal. Wait, actually.
Best start to a podcast ever.
I just got these little sound effects, and I'm like, before I record, just warning you, I have these crazy sound effects. I might be using them. Molly has a big reputation. Wrote a memoir about her incredible life. I just can't wait to just dive into all of the things. Thank you for joining us from North Carolina, Molly.
Katie, thank you so much for having me. Also, the fact that you have some Tay-Tay, you know. Okay, so we're recording this the day after the Grammys when Taylor shocked the nation and my husband could not care less. Like, he is so over my love for Taylor and my daughter's love for Taylor. And when she announced a new album last night, I scrumped and I was just texting all of my Taylor Swift friends, and my husband just was sitting over there like, okay, I am over this.
I can relate so much. Please add me to your text thread. Me and my girls lost our, we were unhinged.
I was unwell. All of us were just like sitting there waiting for the Reputation Taylor's version announcement.
Yes.
And then she's just like, I'll do you one better. And it just was, but my favorite, okay, and then we can move on because people that didn't see this, but okay, everybody that's listening to this podcast,
yes,
for sure saw this. Okay. I am very curious about when they pan to the audience and like Chrissy Teigen is just shocked. She's like, what? I'm very confused about Olivia Rodrigo and Ed Sheeran's faces, because Ed Sheeran and Taylor are friends. And so I'm
he
like,
he had to have known.
No, well, he definitely didn't know. She,
you think?
Oh, for sure. No, but oh my gosh, we could do an entire podcast talking about this
thing,
and then we will move on. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So his face I was confused by, and then Olivia Rodrigo, I just like, wasn't sure where she stood. Okay, but then here's the two things that we're going to discuss really fast, Katie. I realize I've now hijacked.
No, girl, I'm here for it. I'm here for it. This is, but I live for this.
And your audience, I'm sure, is also here for this. So two things I, like, a few different, like, Easter eggs that she clearly planted that now it all makes sense. Okay, in Travis Kelce's Wall Street Journal article, he quotes and says, it is amazing. Like, her brain is beautiful, and it is amazing the way she can turn life into poetry.
He had to have known. I wonder how many people actually knew, though. And some of her inner circle changed her profile picture to black and white, so we were all thinking it was Reputation. But like, they were in on it somehow.
He for sure knew. And she was like, look, you're now in my life, and so you're going to help me plant some Easter eggs. And Travis would totally be on board with this.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's number one. Then have you seen the Joe Alwyn interview thing?
Yes!
That he had a text thread called the Tortured Man Club?
Yes.
She is trolling him, and I am here for it. Okay, see, and then there was like a bunch of other Easter eggs she's clearly posted in the last couple months that I'm just like, it all makes sense now. She is an actual genius.
Mastermind. She's a mastermind.
What a time to be alive. That we are alive at the same time as the world's greatest poet laureate mastermind genius. I am... Katie, okay.
No, it's okay. Because those, I was a Joe Alwyn fan, but now obviously there's a lot of questions, and those tracks are going to come out, and Joe is going to say,
now go stand in the corner and think about what you did.
That is right. Spill the tea, Tay-Tay.
I need the tea. I need it.
I think he did her dirty, and she's like,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You'll live to regret that.
Yes, and that's what she's going to be saying when those tracks come out.
I mean, she dated Jake Gyllenhaal for like 2.5 minutes, and like, he has half an album about him.
I know. All Too Well 10-minute version. I become undone every time.
Okay.
Anyway, right. So now that we're best friends.
Oh, so good. Okay, we are officially besties. This is so good. Yeah, truly. I want to just now start an entire podcast where we just talk about this stuff, because I can't talk about it with my husband. As soon as I start to, he just like rolls his eyes and walks away.
Same. The girls and I were screaming last time. My husband's like, can y'all keep it down? I got to get up early and go to the gym. We're like, rude. How dare you have a life?
Dare you? How dare you? Okay, anyway.
All okay, right. So you wrote a book, a memoir, and you were on Saturday Night Live, and you were inherited a bazillion dollars and then lost it. You have so much to tell. So much to tell.
Well, I should clarify, I was never on Saturday Night Live. I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live, but I did do comedy for a very long time. So I was friends with and did classes with people who have been on Saturday Night Live. But close I should enough. Clarify, I was close never enough. On. I just always wanted to be.
Well, in my book, you were on it.
Oh.
Nice. Okay, so I guess let me just, some of your stories are just so interesting. I am curious how your parents met in AA, because I think that that's crazy and amazing, and I love it.
Yeah. So a little bit about Tom Buckley and Linda Vannevar Buckley. So they met later in life. They were, my dad was married twice before my mom, and my mom was married once, engaged twice, but they met, you know, later in life, and they had, both, and my dad had a daughter from a previous marriage. So I have a half sister. And so my dad was 41 when they met. And my mom was 37. And yeah, 37. And, you know, so my mom was an alcoholic after she got back from Vietnam. And so she was a nurse in the Vietnam War. And as most, not all, but most people returning home from war, she had, you know, some stuff going on. And one of those things was a good old classic case of alcoholism. And then my dad, you know, grew up just in an Irish Catholic household. And I mean, he was born the day before D-Day, like June 5th, 1944. So, you know, and then he grew up just, you know, in a home. He was the oldest of five. My mom was the kind of in the middle of five and kids. And, you know, he developed his alcoholism at a pretty early age. I tell a story in the book that I won't spoil here, but just kind of how it's because it's actually a very funny story of when he was in middle school and got completely hammered at school. And but that essentially like he started using alcohol in his teens as a coping mechanism and just a band-aid for his resentment and his anger and all of that. And so, you know, fast forward many years, and June 22nd, 1979 is the day my dad got sober. And as of, you know, this recording, he's been sober almost 45 years, something like that. Math is hard for me, but
something like
45 years, something like that. And then my mom didn't get sober until 1983. And she actually got sober the day before her birthday. So her birthday is May 27th, and she got sober on May 26th. And she just knew that she was at a point that if she didn't quit, she was going to die. She was going to kill herself. And so, and that was also, you know, while she's going through therapy and she'd gotten divorced. And so, she's going through a lot. And so my mom was living in Northern Virginia. My dad was living in Northern Virginia. And they were attending AA meetings, and they met and were hanging out. They had kind of, you know, some mutual friends, and as recovering alcoholics often do, you know, you find ways to socialize and have fun without alcohol. And so they were having a rousing game of men versus women, Trivial Pursuit. And my dad proceeds to ask the question that if the girls' team gets right, they would win. The girls would win. And so my dad asks this question, and it's something to the effect of like, in 1969, 400,000 people gathered in New York for a legendary music festival. And then he changes the end of the question, and he says, name them. Like, name the 400,000 people that were there.
Oh, gosh.
And my dad and my mom thought it was the funniest thing she'd ever heard in her life. She laughed so hard and just immediately was kind of smitten by him. And they ended up going out on a date. And they had run into each other at a 7-Eleven. And he was getting ice because he was going to go for a picnic with my sister at Harper's Ferry. And so he invited my mom along. And she comes and they had this whole day where they spend at Harper's Ferry and they're laughing and talking and getting to know each other. And, you know, my mom is getting to know my sister and all this. And they're walking back to the car and they're kind of holding hands. And my dad looks at her and has this funny look in his face. And she says, "What?" And he says, "I realize this is going to sound crazy, but we're going to get married and we're going to have a little girl named Molly." And my mom is like, "No, that doesn't sound crazy." And then basically their second date was at a Jewish delicatessen and my dad proposed and then they were married 6 weeks later. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had a very, just a funny start to their marriage, and that definitely carried its way throughout their entire marriage.
And you're the little girl named Molly.
And I am the little girl named Molly. That it, sure enough, it happened.
Wow. That's so cool. I mean, I read that, but it's just even cooler to hear it from your perspective. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Man. Okay. So, I mean, there's just so many things I want to highlight, but like what also stood out is your 8-year-old self giving the State of the Union address to your city council with a sidewalk story. You know,
yes.
I just think that's so interesting because young women, listeners to our podcast, finding your brave, being able to stand up for what you believe. Like, there's just so much to unpack there. But I just picture this little 8-year-old girl with her strong feelings about needing a sidewalk.
Yeah.
And you just got up there. I need to hear that story. It's so cool.
Yes. And the funny thing is, so I have it on VHS and I am trying so hard to get it digitized.
Yes.
But because we recorded it off of like the local C-SPAN feed, you know, whatever it was in Herndon, no company will digitize it for me because it's like copyright protected. And I'm like, but I don't have a VHS player and I really need it.
Yes, with the social media.
Video evidence, people. So I grew up in a town in Virginia called Herndon. It's a small town outside. Well, at the time, it was a very small town outside of Washington, D.C. It's huge now. It's unrecognizable now. But it was kind of an old town in that, like, you know, there's a hub for the Washington and Dulles Railroad, you know, like I think it was called the WOND Railroad system. That was like kind of, that was the hub for it. And it was just kind of a small community, like one stoplight at the time. Now it's like, now, I mean, it's just this bustling metropolis, you know, it's just unrecognizable, but a lot of old homes in the area, a lot of old neighborhoods, like historic homes. Fun fact, do you know the movie is an old movie, Contact with Jodie Foster? It's like it was like early 2000s, late 90s, I think, something like that.
I definitely know Jodie Foster. I feel like I can see the preview, but I don't remember it. Yeah.
So anyway, that movie was like mostly filmed in Herndon, like in an old house in Herndon. Anyway, so I grew up in this really old house. It was 100 years old and there were no sidewalks in our neighborhoods because, you know, when you live in really old neighborhoods, that's just not how neighborhoods were designed. And so, you know, it was also the 80s and 90s. And so what did we do? We played outside all day long, like until the sun went down and the streetlight came on and then we went inside. And I was kind of the older kid in the neighborhood at the time. There was like a lot of kids younger than me and cars would just barrel through our neighborhood. And there were multiple times like where kids would get almost hit by a car. So finally one day it was like there was a really bad incident where my friend Fung had like basically just narrowly been missed by a car. And so I run inside and I say to my parents, I was just like, "We need sidewalks. Like, what do we do to get sidewalks?" And my parents were like, "Well, you would go to the town of Herndon Council and you would tell them that we need sidewalks." And I was like, "Okay.
You're like, I'm available now. Let's go."
Yeah, I'm available. So I look at the town of Herndon calendar. Like, we always got like a free calendar with the town of Herndon events. And happened that night at 7 o'clock, there was a town council meeting. So I go upstairs. Like, my parents didn't like tell me exactly what to do, but I put on my Samantha American Girl doll velvet dress and I typed up a speech on my Macintosh Classic 2. It had it didn't have clip art, but it definitely had like, you know, the fun colored fonts. And I type up this speech and I walk downstairs and I tell my parents that like they're going to take me to the town council meeting, to which they were like, "Oh, okay, like this is definitely normal. For sure, this is a normal thing." And so sure enough, I go and I give this speech and I basically like tell the mayor, like, because when they call for new citizen business, I went up and I read my speech and I told them that we need sidewalks. And of course, they all like thought I was adorable. But then it was like, I was on the cover of like the Herndon Times.
Hey.
I was like very famous at the time. I thought it was a really big deal. And but then they just kept saying like, yeah, we'll get you sidewalks. And then they just never did. And then a couple months later, I went back to the town council. I gave another speech and they're like, sure. Yeah, we'll work on it. And then that wasn't working. So I started like petitions. I started calling. I wrote letters, like all this kind of stuff. It took 2.5 years. Then 2.5 years later, we finally got a knock at the door with an engineer and a town council member. And they asked where to put the sidewalks. And sure enough, they put those sidewalks in. I carved my name in the cement and my name is still there to this day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so what a very early lesson of, you know, stand up for what you want and
that's
you
right.
know, don't back down. And
that's right.
I love it that your parents were all for it too, because they could have been like, no, we have stuff to do tonight, or like, no, like this is silly. But they were like, all right.
Well, let me tell you a funny story that is not in the book. So there's a little like inside thing. So the mayor of our town, I won't say his name because I think he's still in politics. So the mayor of our town, you know, he was a mayor for a really long time. I do tell a story in the book about how I dated his son briefly in eighth grade, which, you know, is just funny that I'm sure that he was like, really? Like, you're dating her? Because he was, he knew who I was. There was no question as to like, who is this girl? Well, so that guy, you know, he was just the mayor of our town for a very long time. But then he kind of worked his way up the political system and then eventually became a Virginia state. He was either like a delegate or a state senator, not like at the national level, but at the statewide level and statewide politics. So, you know, like he would like report to the governor. And so he was, you know, the representative for our area at the state level. And when I was in college, I got really heavily involved in student government and politics and lobbying. And I did some lobbying work with an organization called Virginia 21. That was an organization that lobbied and fought for just more funding for higher education, protecting just different issues in the realm of higher education. Because at the time, you know, in the early 2000s, like tuition rates were just going through the roof, financial aid was down, all this kind of stuff. And so I was student body president and I was kind of tasked with representing my university at the state level. So we would go to the state level and we would speak in front of the governor and the state legislature, and we would get assigned to do some lobbying work where we would have to actually go and meet with individual congressional people. And well, wouldn't you know who I got assigned to?
No.
That is the guy. I won't say his name because I think he's still in politics. But he was the legislator and he was our mayor. And when I saw his name on my list and I made that appointment and I walked in that door, he was like, you have got to be kidding me. The fact that at 8 years old, I bugged the crap out of him for sidewalks. And now I'm 21 and I am bugging the crap out of him for funding for higher education. Needless to say, he voted our way.
Good.
He knew who he was dealing with. But
yeah. Well, politics, though, he's got to respect the persistence. That's what you got to do. You can't just go, hey, one time, can you make changes in our legislative or whatever? It's like,
exactly. Well, and I tell that story here, too, like for your listeners who, you know, a lot of them might be in college or just out of college. And just, you know, I mean, my convictions were strong. And so I was not going to let take no for an answer. And so that's an encouragement to, you know, whatever your beliefs are, you know, to stand
yes.
up for them. And maybe you never know who you might come into contact.
I love it. Oh my gosh. I want to get into comedy and the book and everything, but I guess kind of just piggybacking off that too, your testimony a little bit, because I know you tell the story so funny about reciting, was it the prayer from AA in a church, and then realizing, wait, that's not the way you're supposed to do it.
It was the Lord's Prayer, but the way that people in AA do it. Yes.
So funny. And just the they drug you along to a lot of the meetings, right? When you were young, the AA meeting.
Yeah. Yeah. I was always going to AA meetings with them. And because, you know, I mean, they weren't getting a babysitter. And so a lot of times they were in churches. And so I would just go to like down the hall to a little Sunday school classroom or something and just play and color while they were in their meetings.
Yeah. But eventually you had your own meeting of the Lord story. And yeah, I would just love for you to unpack it.
Yeah. Well, the whole story is obviously in book form, but
yes.
But the short version. So I kind of alluded to it. I don't know if I've said this explicitly. So my mom died when I was a senior in high school, and I didn't grow up knowing the Lord, and I didn't have the spiritual and emotional and mental tools to deal with a loss like that. And, you know, when you're grieving and nobody really points you in the direction of like a counselor or anything, you know, I went to a very dark place very quickly. And so that was fall of my senior year of high school. And I just pretty quickly began to spiral. And then in college, I used the pursuit of success and identity and money and popularity. And they were all things that I was idolizing and chasing after to numb the pain of what I was going through. And, you know, of course, like anytime you place something in the position in your heart of the place that only God can fill, you will end up disappointed because the idols of this world, money, power, fame, success, all of that, like that, you know, it's going to disappoint you. And by my senior year of college, I inherited, shockingly and surprisingly, nearly $250,000 from my mom's estranged family. So it was my 21st birthday, and I got a check, like a paper check in the mail with shy of $250,000. And that was after taxes. So that was just like $250,000 cash all of a sudden in my pocket. And so when you don't have the tools to know what to do with that, what happens? Well, very quickly, I'm like, oh, well, now I have money. So this is going to for sure fix it. Like whatever it is that is broken within me. And I always try to like give myself some credit. I did give some of it to my dad. I gave some of it to my sister. I started a scholarship at my school that is still going to this day. So wow. Like I did do some good with it. And then the rest of it, I just completely blew. And within 2 years, less than 2 years, I had not only spent every last penny that I had, but I ended up over $36,000 in consumer credit card debt. And so by June of 2008, I was just deep in debt. I was depressed. I was suicidal. I was the lowest. Well, I thought that I couldn't possibly get lower. I did. And you know, but I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I just carried a lot because nobody knew what was going on. I had kept this a secret from people for a very, very long time. And so I was isolating myself. I began the process of trying to get out of debt, but it was painful and it was rough. And then I moved from Virginia to North Carolina in 2009. And then by the spring of 2010, I was working 4 jobs trying to get out of debt. I was, you know, I mean, literally two jobs a day, 7 days a week, you know, everywhere from I would sometimes go to one job as early as like 5:30 in the morning. Get off that job and then, you know, go to work. And especially if I worked at a restaurant the night before, you know, I would work till 2:30 in the morning. I'd go home, get maybe a couple hours sleep, and then go back and do the same thing all over again. And so I was running myself ragged. I was, again, just isolated. I was deeply depressed and just struggling to get out of debt, struggling to make ends meet, and really, really hit that emotional, spiritual rock bottom. I had hit financial rock bottom, you know, 2 years prior, but I was nowhere near like crawling myself out of that rock bottom. And so that, you know, it just continued to get worse until that summer. On the outside, I looked great. No one knew. Absolutely no one knew. I was just put up this facade that was stellar. But by that summer, I had started kind of just talking. You know, the kids these days, they still use the word talking, right? You know, I was talking to this guy. I was talking to this guy that I work with. And I really liked him, but you know, we were clearly friends, but I very obviously had a crush on him, and we started hanging out. We were not boyfriend, girlfriend, but we started hanging out. But very quickly I realized there was something different about him. I come to find out he was a Christian. He had been a Christian his whole life. And there was just, you know, there was just something different about him. And it's funny because he would say this, like, even for him at that point in his life, that was probably like the lowest point of his life, like spiritually. And even then, like, he still was like eons better than, like, so I always tell him, I'm like, well, you were doing something right. And so we'd been kind of seeing each other for a couple of months and hanging out. And by September, I asked if I could go to church with him. Mm. And I had gotten to a point where I realized that I could no longer pick myself up by my non-existent bootstraps. I could no longer carry the weight of the world on my own shoulders that I had been trying, just that I was being crushed under the weight of all of this. And so finally I went to church with him, and it wasn't a moment of I raised my hand and like surrendered my life to God, but that was, you know, it didn't make sense as to why I asked to go to church with him, but it became very clear that this was like, I heard the gospel for the first time, and I was able to realize like, oh, okay. Like there's actually hope. There is a God in heaven who loves me and created me on purpose with a purpose for a purpose. Like there was this glimmer of hope that I saw for the very first time. And so I left that day and I felt hope for the first time in years. And so I started going to church every single Sunday after that. And, very quickly, like, surrendered my life to God. I started tithing. I auditioned to serve on the worship team. And I became a member at the church. Like, I mean, I went on a mission trip. And so it was just kind of like, I decided to follow Jesus and there was no turning back. And, you know, and life has not been easy since then. But when you have a kingdom perspective and you build your life and your identity and your self-worth on the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and you put your hope and your faith in Jesus and not in the fleeting idols of this world, everything changes, everything. And so here I am, you know, 13 and a half, 14 years later, still talking about it, and will be till the day I die. So yeah, that's the short version, believe it or not.
No, it's so good. I just wanted you to share that because it's so powerful. And I mean, obviously a big part of the book and a big part of your story and what you're doing now and all of that good stuff. I love it. I love it.
Well, thank you.
Okay. So speaking of which, if I don't laugh, I'll cry. When did you decide that obviously I'm thankful that you did, but like to write it all down, tell me about the process. What has all that been like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd always wanted to write a book. My mom was a writer. My mom published her memoir in 1983. It's called Home Before Morning.
And yes, I read that. I need to go check out her book.
Yeah, it was the first nonfiction account of the war from the perspective of a woman.
Wow.
And so I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I'd always wanted to write a book, but it certainly like never really knew like what I wanted to write a book about. But then in the last 10 years or so, you know, after I got saved, it was pretty clear that I was going to need to write a book about my testimony, but I didn't know what or what it was going to look like or any of that. I mean, I was very unclear as to the direction and just kind of prayed through, all right, God, like what is it that you would have me to write? And funny enough, my first proposal I wrote for the book was in the summer of 2017. And that book proposal is like a very, very different book than what has gone to print. You know what I mean? It's just a very, very different book, and in a good way. You know, that the message began to become more clear in the last few years. And yeah, and so I'm not going to lie to you. Like, this has been a very fun, grueling, beautiful, difficult process. It has been a very long time. Like, from the time I actually signed a contract from the time I signed a contract with an agent to publishing will be 2.5 years. But from when I actually signed a book publishing contract, it'll be 2 years when the book comes out. So, you know, it's not a quick process. So I've had a lot of people say, you know, like, oh, I'm interested in writing a book. Can we talk about it? I'm like, you have to be the most passionate about this thing, because by the time it comes out, you will be like, I am so sick of my own words. It became very clear as to what the story was supposed to be. And it was supposed to be the whole story, because there's a lot of the pieces of my testimony that I had kept very secret for a long time because of shame and embarrassment and guilt that I had been wrestling with and dealing with. And so, you know, while the book is a memoir and it is my testimony, this is something I say throughout the book. And it's something I've kind of been, you know, I've said in the trailer for it and stuff, is like, while this is my story, it's actually not. It's God's story, but it's also all of our stories. Yeah. Because if we live long enough, all of us are going to go through periods of just deep pain and deep suffering and also unbridled joy and love and life. The beauty and the brutality of life is living it in the tension of grief and joy and pain and elation and sorrow and celebration. Like, that is life. And the whole, like, if I don't laugh, I'll cry. Like, I grew up in a home of parents who, we were dealing with just some of the most unimaginable things. And yet my parents, I never saw them sacrifice their sense of humor. Like, they definitely lived out the motto of like, if they don't laugh, they'll cry. And so, like, you know, making light of really difficult situations, which some people would say like, oh, that's unhealthy. And I'm like, no, in a lot of ways for me, it helped me. Certainly, I believe that there is a time and absolutely crying is okay and grief is okay and anger is okay. But also, like, God gave us the gift of laughter. And I love that verse, Proverbs, I think it's Proverbs 17:22. Like, a laughter does the heart good like medicine. And so when we are sick, whether that is from emotional unwellness or you know, just like, laughter is so good. I mean, you think about like, when you go to visit somebody in a hospital and like, you do something to cheer them up, like, you're not taking away from their pain. You're actually like ministering to them and providing medicine to them through smile and laughter and what's actually happening chemically in the body as you laugh and how it really does. It releases endorphins and dopamine and all these things that help counteract all the other things that are happening in your body. And so that's really the hope and the goal of this book, is I want people to laugh. There are very, very funny stories.
Yes, there are.
They will cry. There are also some incredibly sad stories in the book. And you know, it's also a book that I want people to see their own story in it, their own wrestling with shame and guilt, their own wrestling with pain and suffering, their own wrestling with search for identity. And ultimately, like the final message of the book is really like, the things of this world are fleeting and we cannot place our identity and our self-worth on those things. And in the end, like we have to run after the only one who, you know, who will never disappoint us and who will never let us down. And so that's really the goal of it. And I mean, so far from people that have read it, I think it's doing what I prayed that it would do. And so, you know, but it's a very vulnerable thing because, you know, as you put this out into the world, inevitably there are going to be people that are not going to like it. And I'll be like, this is my story. You know, it's a very vulnerable thing. And I'm, you know, I'm airing a lot of my own very personal junk. So that's a pretty intimidating process.
Well, just the cover, the picture of you as, I don't know, a little girl and like intentionally like two or three chins, like just poking up.
Yeah. Well, and I love that picture. It's kind of an iconic, you know, kid picture of me.
Yeah.
And, but what I love about it is like, you don't know, like, am I about to cry or am I about to laugh?
It's
true. Don't know. And so that's like the whole point of that picture. It's like, not just that it's an iconic picture of me as a child, but like the emotion behind it is like, is she going to laugh? Is she going to cry? I don't know. And the answer is yes.
Yeah. Either way, you will have big feelings and I'm here for it.
Sure. 100%.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm so excited. This comes out in March. We'll make sure this episode airs on its date because that's just a very big and exciting time for an author. Yay! And I want to celebrate you and all the work that you poured into this.
Thank you.
No, and I love memoirs anyway. I just, you know, I always say our stories are our best offering. And
agree.
Sharing your story is such a, as you said, vulnerable, but real and relatable. And you do it in a funny way. And what's not to love about that? So
Thank you. Yes. March 26th. And if you love the sounds of my vocal cords, I do read my own audiobook and, which was really fun to do. And I, you know, tried to like, there's one chapter where I do the actual voices of characters from a show that I put on and I sang in it. And so I tried to put in some fun elements to make the book come to life. So if you're an audiobook person, recommend getting that audiobook.
Yeah. We didn't even talk about you sing and do comedy. Like there's so many, there's so much to unpack.
Yeah.
We'll do another podcast, talk about that and Taylor Swift.
Yes. Yes. I actually, Katie, I think you and I need to just start a Taylor Swift podcast where we can just sit and we can discuss all of the theories and all the stuff.
I am so here for it.
Yes. Yes. Love it.
Oh, thank you so much, Molly. What a pleasure to get to chat with you. And I can't wait to share this episode.
So fun. Thank you so much for having me, Katie. It has been an absolute honor.